and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley, and I'm the founder of Blogosphere, which hopefully you've heard of. But if not, Blogosphere is a media company rooted in the world of influencers. We run events, an influencer network, and publish a nationally distributed print magazine, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @BlogosphereM. And if you want to learn more about influencers and the influencer industry, be sure to visit blogosphere magazine.com and invest in a subscription to our essential magazine. I'm delighted to announce that this series of Serious Influence is being exclusively sponsored by our very own tech platform, the Blogosphere Network. The Blogosphere Network is a platform where brands and influencers can feedback on what it was actually like to work with each other on campaigns. Real, qualitative data. If you'd like a demo of the service, please drop us an email at info@blogosphere.biz. That's info@blogosphere.biz. It's time to bring back the human touch to this human industry. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by Amy Shearer, who is Head of Influencer Marketing at Mumsnet. Amy has worked in the influencer space since 2011 and actually started her own blog all the way back in 2006.
I am Head of Influencer Marketing at Mumsnet.
And what is the background to your career? What did you kind of study at university? How did you get up the ladder to this position?
So I went to university thinking I was going to be a journalist. So I actually studied American Studies and English because I grew up in the States, although I'm British. And that wasn't really related to anything. So then I graduated during the recession and, as chance would have it, had experience in marketing and not journalism. So that's what I did. But I really enjoyed the storytelling side of marketing and stuff and engaging people with the content you're creating. So there was a link in terms of what I loved about journalism. My career started at Telefonica in app development and then the brand management team. Everything from telling people, yes, you may use that formation of bubbles, but not that Pantone colour blue, right through to sort of launching 4G across the country and Be More Dog, if any of the listeners remember that campaign.
And what was that campaign?
Be More Dog. That was actually my first experience of bloggers.
Okay.
And we were kind of dabbling. It was a really great place to start because at the time, I mean, this is kind of back in 2011 or so, O2 was sort of ahead of the game in terms of social. So I was learning about all walks of marketing, somewhere where telecoms, we had loads of budget. It was a great, fun place, but also really top quality. And I was just surrounded by really intelligent people who were really experimenting with all of these new digital aspects of marketing. Fast forward, I went freelance, was a social media manager, community, brand management, kind of everything.
I do want to just talk about Be More Dog. So this is the first time that you start being aware of bloggers. So could you tell me a bit more about that campaign? And
so the social and PR team, basically
at Telefonica,
at O2, who were owned by Telefonica, they sent boxes out to different bloggers. Truth be told, I can't remember who at the time, but one half of it was Be More Cat. And if you opened up that box, it had a DVD, it had like a hot chocolate mix, fluffy socks, stuff for a night in, nice and cozy, a little bit dull. And if you went with the Be More Dog box, we sent bloggers skydiving and they were like all big challenges to basically encourage you to get out of your comfort zone. So the TV ad that went along with that was a cat that decides to be more dog. It was a bit of a Marmite campaign at the time. Some people loved it, some people hated it, but it was good fun. And in terms of working with bloggers, in parallel, there was another campaign we did with Sony Xperia hand launch, and we got loads of bloggers down. And the big thing about that handset was that it had an amazing camera for the time. So we basically got a bunch of bloggers down to a haunted house because it was around Halloween, and they had to film their experience of the haunted house on the Sony Xperia. We then formatted that, or our agency did, into a video for our YouTube channel to showcase how good the camera was. And all those bloggers then featured their footage on their YouTube channels. So this is like nearly 10 years ago. It was quite forward thinking for the time, but it was accessing that teenage demographic, which at the time were the only people on YouTube.
Are we in 2008 or?
Probably about 2011, not quite 10 years.
Okay. Did you find that
O2 specifically were looking to YouTube as opposed to looking at Twitter or blogs?
So in terms of working with, Instagram was neither here nor there then. But in terms of working with bloggers, yes, it was blogs and YouTube. O2 had quite a strong YouTube channel. I think we had three of them, actually. We had one for Priority, one for the O2 gurus, who were like our help desk type personality, and one for kind of O2 proper. And there was a job, as I was leaving, they were kind of combining the three into one because they realised they were diversifying a bit far. But in terms of a brand, I mean, Twitter was huge for O2. When we were doing the iTunes sponsorship for the festival, Twitter was one of our main ways of doing giveaways. We ended up trending higher than the iTunes Festival hashtag at one point because our ticket giveaways for that night were so popular. And so, yeah, Twitter was huge for them back then.
I still think that Twitter can be so useful for brand voice today.
Absolutely.
If you get it right.
Yeah. I think it lives and dies by whoever's on the team as well. Like, I remember another time, not to talk about O2 the whole time, but there was another time where one of the guys in the social team literally just started speaking in the dialect, like writing in the dialect on Twitter back to this guy in customer service. And it went viral as a discussion. And, you know, they were commended by Campaign and Marketing Week and saying, this is how you do social. But that wouldn't have happened without that guy sitting there and just having that idea. So you do have to have the kind of freedom within your social team and the right people. They know the brand and that tone of voice so well that they also know how they can play with it and how they can have a bit of fun and really sort of light a fire under the community, really, that are there.
I think KFC last year, when they ran out of chicken, there's some crazy statistic about like uplift in sales purely for doing what? FKD.
Yeah. That was just a beautiful example of letting your team have a bit of fun, but do it in the right way. Mm. Definitely.
So in 2011, what was your personal relationships with blogs? Were you an avid blog reader yourself? Or?
So I've been blogging since I was about 18. I was the one that all of my friends teased as, oh, you're the blogger. I've had one about when I went travelling. I had one about baking at university. And then once I became a parent, my natural way of going like, oh my God, I'm pregnant. I'm going to be a mum was, oh, I'll start a blog.
So what year did you first start that first blog then?
That would have been 2007.
Okay. So one of the early adopters, because I think it was 2006 that was the first generation of, you know, Liberty London girls. So
yeah. I mean, mine was no good.
Well, you had the initiative to start, though, and could see it.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the States, as I mentioned. So my friends were in the States on Facebook, and they were like, why are you still on MySpace? Ditch that, come to Facebook. So I got all my friends in the UK on Facebook. I was the first of my friends to have Twitter, first to have Instagram. So I've always been quite an early adopter when it comes to tech. And
why do you think
social.
That is? Does that link back to your passion for storytelling?
Very possibly. My dad has worked in telecom since before I was born. So I was also the first of my friends to have a phone, a mobile. I've always been around the new tech because he's really into it. So that might play a part in it as well. I've just kind of always known about the new tech before most people.
So talk to me a little bit about the move then. Do you go straight from O2 to Mumsnet?
No. So I freelanced for a couple of years in between. That was quite a varied period. I was consulting with a lot of small startups, lots of mumtrepreneurs, love or hate the word, apps, children's wear, a currency broker, everything from brand management through to here's how you write a social strategy and how you exercise it without it swallowing up all of your time. I worked with Danone for a bit in that time and then eventually came back to working full-time in a really small boutique agency, and they specialised in family and education marketing, predominantly offline, and I was brought in. 50% of my role was actually managing their online presence and kind of managing their inbound marketing strategy. So looking at SEO, social, and how you can effectively bring the audience to you rather than constantly having to go to them.
Had you started your parenting blog at this time? What year are we in now?
That would be beginning of 2016. Yeah, so I started my parenting blog in 2013.
And that's still going?
No. I finished that 2 years ago. I'm still on Instagram and still on Twitter, but I reached a point where it was actually when I joined Mumsnet, and I kind of thought, I'm at a point with the blog where I either go hell for leather on the blog and I really try and make that work, or I go hell for leather on my more normal career path. And for me, that was the right decision, having a child and everything, it, although you can potentially work flexibly with a blog, the steady paycheck was welcome. But also, I think in my heart of hearts, I'm better at telling other people how to do their strategy really well. And actually, I don't want to have my personal life be broadcast. That's just a personal choice. And so I wasn't as good and my heart wasn't as in it as it could have been, really.
So apart from the steady paycheck, what else was it that drew you to Mumsnet? And obviously it was founded, I believe, in 2000.
Yes.
So had you been aware of it before becoming a mother?
Yes. So not so much before becoming a mum, if I'm honest. Obviously, we all know the penis beaker thread. That was before I was a mum. And that did the rounds with me and my friends.
That was, I think, my first introduction to Mumsnet.
That seems to be a lot of people's first introduction. It's kind of a baptism of fire.
Yeah, 2013, penis beaker. I was working at the Telegraph newspaper at that time, so I remember that doing the rounds.
Yes. The media like us for our interesting thread choices.
Well, we'll come on to that.
I'm sure we will. So it was more actually through the blogging community that I got to know Mumsnet. So they have a blogger network, which I am now in charge of. And so I joined as a parent blogger. And they used to run a big annual conference called Blogfest. I went to that. I went to their Workfest event as well that they used to run, which was all about getting women back into work. And that was just as I was coming back into kind of agency life full time. And it was sort of ideas of how do you juggle parent life and family life with your work and aspirations of your career, and really interesting talks about female empowerment and things like that. So that was kind of my introduction to the brand. And I kind of agreed with all of that. It was things that were important to me, and to be a part of that conversation and sort of helping that conversation grow was really important to me. So it was a natural fit from that perspective.
So in terms of the bloggers that were introducing you to Mumsnet, it was under that umbrella of flexible working. And because in terms of Mumsnet's reputation, I feel that that element of it is often kind of lost in mainstream coverage. Why do you think that is? And I was reading an article, I believe it was in the New Statesman, from a very pro Mumsnet blogger, who is saying that it's just easier to reduce the Mumsnet community to misogynistic caricatures. So what are your thought processes on that?
I agree. I think we are very easy fodder on a slow news day for some other news outlets, shall we say.
Do you feel that you're, as a community, you're a bit of a scapegoat? Obviously, in 2018, sort of the summer of that, it was very much on the transphobic accusations where you had activist groups that were lobbying advertisers to withdraw their ads due to threads. And I think the founder, Justine Roberts, was talking about the worrisome effect of social media becoming linked to sort of the thought police, and that barrier between freedom of speech and hate speech. What would you say?
It's a big question.
It is a big question.
Going backwards one step, I do think we've become a bit of a scapegoat for all of it, partly because we're one of the last remaining sites or platforms that is allowing any kind of discussion, rightly or wrongly, depending on your perspective. But there does come a point, I think, where you have to accept that we are a culture that allows freedom of speech. That needs to be respectful. It needs to be constructive. And that's what we have really worked hard over the last 6 months, especially to ensure, especially around things like the trans debate.
Because you've actually blocked some words on forums, isn't it?
We have, so yes. So
TERF and cis are both banned.
And that actually caused a lot of debate in itself, because the trans community felt that they were being silenced. But our perspective was that they may feel derogatory to somebody who is on the receiving end of them. So we've basically banned any words that may derail a conversation from either perspective, because we are encouraging a constructive and healthy debate. Everyone's entitled to their own opinion, whether it's right or wrong. It's just really making sure that that's being managed in an appropriate way for everyone involved.
Just going to clarify what those terms mean for listeners. So TERF is trans exclusionary radical feminist, and cis is a descriptive word for when you agree with the gender that you've been assigned at birth.
Yes.
Right. Do you think that although the mainstream press use Mumsnet as a easy fodder, or that actually it's not alienated this sort of cancel culture and suddenly things escalating to being labelled as sort of transphobic or racist, that is actually indicative of social media as a whole, and that we're really, for something that's supposed to give us freedom of speech, that actually more people are now feeling that they're restrained, and what elements and things can be brought in to combat that.
Yeah, I mean, there's all this discussion on Facebook, on every platform, about your echo chamber. Mumsnet does have a risk of being its own echo chamber. We are predominantly, I think we're 80% female on the platform now. That in itself creates an echo chamber because it's mainly women. Now, that can be a real positive, obviously, because it's really encouraging women to have open conversations, support each other through divorce, through abusive relationships, whatever it might be. But you're not seeing the other side, not of the abusive relationships part. That's obviously a given. But, you know, whatever the other side of that might be. Equally, we are not exclusive. We have 20% men. I think there's always going to be different types of people drawn to different platforms. I mean, if you look at Instagram, it can be, for some people, just as anxiety-inducing and have as many problems. It's just, I think you've kind of got to take a bit of ownership for yourself and what you are willing to sort of allow yourself to see, and be a little bit more of your own editor and creator about what you're seeing. Because obviously we get so much information on the internet these days. It can be overwhelming. I mean, sometimes I just sort of look at my Instagram and think, oh my God, this, I'm following so many people, especially with my job. I'm like, ah. And you do just sort of have to be a little bit mature about it and go, do you know what? Today is not a day for that. And I'm going to go and just read a physical magazine and sort of.
Got to love a physical magazine.
Yeah. Well,
blogosfairmagazine.com. So, what does your job actually kind of day to day involve?
So, a lot of people don't realise there's actually a marketing agency behind Mumsnet. We kind of live in the shadows, or at least we have in the past. So our aim as an agency is to obviously help brands access the parent demographic and understand them, particularly mums, but more broadly parents. And then also women aged 25 to 44 is our core demographic. So we kind of spill into that a little bit as well, because mums are women too. We like things other than diapers, guys. Sorry, nappies. You can see my American upbringing coming out. So my team are particularly, obviously, influencer marketing. As I mentioned, we have the old blogger network. We got rebranded last year. We brought in a big data platform, which basically tracks all of our influencers' channels, their demographics of the audience. So we can see things like the age, their location, what their brand affinity is to that brand.
Do they sign up to that, or is that just your existing user base?
That's our existing user base, but we have new people joining the network every single week. And it's an opt-in network. We would never add somebody that didn't want to be added. They come to us and say, please let us join.
And how many people have you got on your
network? We've got over 10,000 now. We were one of the first. We were back in 2010, the blogger network started, but at the time it was purely sort of an editorial community aspect of the site. It was just that people started saying on the forum, oh, I've started a blog. Does anyone else have a blog? So they set up the network as sort of somewhere to bring them all together, share their skills. You know, the algorithms change so quickly that it's really beneficial for these guys to have somewhere that they can kind of centrally come and learn and share skills and what have you. And I was brought in 2017 to effectively commercialize that, because more and more of our clients on the agency side were saying, we have a blogger review this as well. And that was working, but obviously there was so much more they could be doing. So yeah, it's been 18 months now. We're doing all right.
How has it developed in that kind of 18 months? And in terms of the network, is that introducing brands to the members or facilitating the deals or acting sort of as a management?
So we don't do talent management currently.
Currently.
One day.
News.
One day.
News story.
I would love to do that, but it's not something that we currently could make it work. But yeah, fingers crossed, maybe one day in the future. So we more work on a campaign management, sort of traditional agency style method, where a brief comes in and we will then effectively put that out to tender with our network and say, are you available? Here is the rate, here's the content that would need to be involved. And if you are game, sign up. And we then go through, we curate a short list for our clients. And if they have hypothetically 5 influencers on a campaign, we might give them a short list of 10 names that we can go through our data platform and say, well, they did these 6 campaigns with us last year. They performed really well and we can see that their channels are growing, their engagement rate is growing. We trust them, they're reliable, they produce good quality content. The clients work with us because we have that relationship and we can see how they're doing.
Do you think members of your network are becoming more professional as the industry matures?
Absolutely.
And have you ever been stung with people that aren't delivering content on time? And do you think that there is more that needs to be done within the industry to hold both parties, brands and influencers, accountable? And that's 3 questions.
Yes, yes, yes. Can I just say yes to everything? So question one, yes, everyone's getting more and more professional. What we find is that the gap between people who are joining the network fresh and the people who've maybe even been with us only a year, getting them, the new guys kind of trained up and understanding what's expected, that gap is so much bigger now. They have a much steeper learning curve. Whereas people who maybe have been around since sort of 2012, 2013, 2014, they've had a much safer space to test and learn and grow. And they've kind of hit that maybe 50K bracket, as in 50K followers on Instagram, hypothetically. They've had longer to get there. So the pool of people we can choose from is really strong, which means that the new guys coming through have a harder job. They have to get there faster or they just aren't going to get the work, which I think is a struggle for them. The flip side of that is that a lot of the people who maybe are starting blogs now obviously are doing it for commercial reasons. And that's the other major difference that we're seeing. People are signing up to our commercial campaigns much earlier on in their blogging career or YouTuber career or whatever. Whereas 3 or 4 years ago, people did it because it was a hobby, especially in the parenting space. You know, so many women either start them when they're on maternity leave, which is what I did. I was bored at home and wanted a creative outlet and a way to just keep on top of what was happening on the social platforms, because I was really conscious in my line of work, saying, oh my God, they're going to be completely different in 12 months' time. How on earth will I catch up? Equally, women are feeling like they can't financially go back to work because childcare is just so expensive, especially once you've had your second child. For most women, it's not feasible. So they end up at home and then they're really creative, they're intelligent women, and they're just bored or feel as though they've got so much more to say and to offer. So they end up starting their own platform to do that. And then you're kind of stuck because they don't have the media training. They don't necessarily come from that marketing background, but they've got the intelligence and they've got the kind of business nous. And it's about how do you bring all that together to make sure they can reach that level where they start getting paid for it. Remind me what question 2 was.
Well,
oh, have we ever been stung
yeah.
by content? Yes. I think everyone in the industry at the moment, and this is part of that safe test and learn phase, you don't really have that anymore. People just expect results, which rightly so. If you're paying money for a campaign, you expect results.
What are the results that brands, when they come to you, are looking for?
The 3 main pockets, I suppose, would be brand awareness or an increase in brand sentiment, driving sales, which is probably the hardest one at the moment with regards to influencer marketing, I think.
In terms of trackability?
Trackability, but also the nature of people don't stick around on social. So if it's an Instagram campaign, for example, people swipe as opposed to really genuinely staying on that single post for long enough that they could then click through. Or whereas on Pinterest, for example, it's like most people use it to shop. I think you've got to be quite targeted and quite sensible and smart about how you use different social channels for different things.
Do you think that brands have fallen head over heels for Instagram and that actually that's a bit of a mistake and that we are going to reach peak Instagram? So you say, like, with Pinterest, people are using it to shop through. With YouTube, it's more of a search platform as well. So something's going to, that will be on there is kind of evergreen. And that with Instagram, although there are lots of followers and, you know, 1 billion monthly active users, that actually it's just a new form of display ads.
I think that's a really good way of describing it, actually. Yeah. I think for brand awareness, Instagram can be really, really powerful. With swipe up on stories, we've seen some really great engagement in a campaign last summer for Disney Healthy Living. And we gave each influencer a trackable link so we could really see how many clicks they were driving. And that swipe up, click through to sign up, we saw great results. But
it hasn't been messed with yet by Facebook.
Yes, I'm sure it will come. But in terms of actually the grid posting, we would never try and use a post on the grid to actually drive click through or sign up or anything like that. It's purely brand awareness in how we work, because there's no way of tracking it.
And you'll just disappoint the client if you...
Exactly. And ROI and establishing that ROI is kind of crucial at the moment, partly as the industry develops, but also in just trying to make sure it's sustainable and that we've all got jobs in a couple of years. We need to do that. So you wouldn't... Well, we personally don't take that gamble. We only would have metrics that we can definitely track back and show how we've really driven whatever the KPI was for that campaign.
When a brand comes to you and wants to advertise, do some of those briefs come through and they say, we want an Instagram post, and then it's part of your job to say, look, we can do the Instagram post, but it should be part of a bigger campaign because that's going to be more strategic and therefore successful?
Absolutely. I think agencies are leading the way in this space at the moment, and it's kind of our job to ensure that we are providing those recommendations, because we're the ones who are actually sitting here going, well, this is changing and that's changing. And a lot of brands don't yet have an influencer manager or team in their in-house. It's being managed a bit by social, a bit by PR, maybe digital and e-coms and performance marketing. So it's very piecemeal. And we're kind of the central, especially in a team like mine where we are specializing in influencer marketing. We're just on top of what's happening on that in that industry and the changes and expectations. So you've got to push back if you don't think it's going to perform, or you don't think actually this is going to do the job you want, or it will, but this would do it better. You've got to push back, because as a group, I really believe we've got to work with great integrity across the industry to make sure it lasts.
Do you think that there are actually a lot of agencies who aren't working with integrity and who are trying to make that quick, easy buck, and actually it is detrimental to the industry as a whole? If we're looking at kind of the influencer marketing space, I think the statistics are that trust is at an all-time low. So is that part of the solution?
Yeah, I think integrity is one of the biggest challenges we're facing in the influencer industry at the moment from all sides. Influencers obviously have seen a massive dip this summer with fake followers and all of that. But if you're an influencer who's growing your channels with integrity, you know that you won't be buying your followers. And if you're producing good content that's authentic, that's true, blah, 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 all the good buzzwords, you will last. Your followers will stick with you and you will outperform eventually the people who aren't acting with integrity. And I think it's the same for agencies and brands, in that if you keep pushing forward with the best quality, the best version of influence marketing that you can, without just trying to do everything really quick and kind of just to get it done, that's how it's going to grow in the best way it can, really.
Can you give me an example of one of the campaigns that you've worked on and how that kind of works from start to finish? Are you very much kind of reactive to briefs that come in, or do you go out and try and find the deals too?
It's a bit of a changeable one. And because we're part of the much larger Mumsnet platform, we work on a wide variety of things. So, for example, we worked with McDonald's over the whole of 2018, practically. It started back in January with our insight team, and they worked with hundreds of Mumsnet users. McDonald's realised that their Happy Meal had kind of plateaued. It hadn't changed for a while. Parents weren't really coming to McDonald's for Happy Meals anymore with their kids. So they worked with users to effectively say, well, what do you want with a Happy Meal? What are we doing wrong? And off the back of that came this, anyone who's been into a McDonald's, obviously you'll have seen they've got those new screen menus now. So that makes pick and mix style menuing.
Every one of which
easier.
Has particles of poo on it. It's not the latest. That's the latest news story.
Great. This is why I carry hand sanitizer in my bag. So you can basically pick and mix on a Happy Meal now. So you can get them a cheeseburger, have the treat, but have it with a bottle of water and maybe some apples. Slices, so that actually it's a treat, but you don't feel completely guilty and like a terrible parent. Alternatively, you can still get it with fries and a Coke if that's what you want. And then they introduced a wrap, which they'd never had in the Happy Meal before. I think it's a grilled chicken wrap. And the other thing that came out was there's no vegetarian option in the Happy Meal, and that's still in development. So this pick and mix and the grilled wrap came out. And in the summer, the big marketing push was all through the influencer network. So we kind of tag teamed with our insight and the users on platform. And then we were the only digital marketing partner for this Happy Meal launch. And we basically split the campaign. So we had four relatively big micro influencers on the campaign, people like Rummy Mummy, Honest Mum, Toby and Rue, and Emily Leary of A Mummy Too. And then we had a pool of smaller mini micros, as we call them, which are under 100,000 followers. But many of them have a higher engagement rate, above 7% or so, some of them pushing as high as 15 or 20%. So you kind of get that really deep engagement with their audience that maybe you're not going to get with the bigger name, but with the bigger name, you get that mass awareness. So we kind of tag team. And then in both of those groups, it was split again. So 50% had really high brand affinity with McDonald's and 50% had relatively low. And the idea was that with the high brand affinity, it was, you're probably already shopping at McDonald's. Here's even more reason to love them and to believe in them and to bring your children and to feel even no guilt now, or minimized guilt. With the group that had low brand affinity, the content had a very different tone and messaging, and it was much more about changing perceptions. And they were much more skewed toward a foodie audience. They were people that had trust and authority when talking about healthy food for families and family eating and cooking. And they were talking about how, I never, ever would have gone to McDonald's prior to this. Actually now, yeah, I'm okay with this idea because I can get my kid a wrap with some apple and some water. And actually, that's no different to Pret. So what's the difference? And the result of that, I think it was about 11 blog posts. I mean, it wasn't huge. They all did Instagram. They all did Twitter. We had a couple of vlogs. I think it was a few hundred thousand views on the content and impressions. And McDonald's saw a 2% uplift in sales of Happy Meals over the summer.
Wow.
So the word of mouth that spreads via this kind of smaller group is vast. And so we're very targeted in how we choose our influencers. And that, I think, comes from the fact that we know them so well because we are on the network with them. My team has a personal relationship with a lot of them. And we sit and chat to them on DM, on Instagram and things, and give them advice about how to grow their channels. There's more to it than just, we're not just an agency, we're the network as well. And that's definitely, that helps when it comes to choosing who works on which campaign.
At the core of that campaign, you obviously mentioned that there were all the different social platforms involved. Would you say that what has the most trust as a platform is the blog or YouTube?
That's a really good question. I think it probably would depend on the person who's watching or reading, because one of the girls in my team is just total YouTube. She's grown up on YouTube. She loves YouTube. She probably wouldn't read a blog if she was choosing. Whereas for me, obviously having originally wanting to be a journalist, I've always written, I love writing, I love reading. My own Instagram is mostly books. So for me, my go-to would be a blog. I don't think you can sort of blanket the answer to that because it's so personal.
I feel like trust in Instagram specifically is quite low because maybe it is getting to a point where it's become rather saturated with ads.
Yes. Not just in terms of, obviously, influencers are increasingly doing ad posts, but also because then there's the paid social side as well. So you can easily scroll for at least 8 or 10 images and not actually see something that doesn't have some form of spend behind it, which people didn't sign up for when they joined Instagram 5, 8 years ago, whenever it was. So yeah, I think they have a bit of finding themselves to do. But Facebook's gone the same way. I mean, Twitter has sponsored posts all the time. I think it's what happens with a new medium. I mean, growing up in the States, on cable TV, like there was ads every 7 minutes. That might be a slight exaggeration, but as a kid, that's what it felt like. Whereas now, my daughter doesn't really watch terrestrial TV apart from CBeebies. So she never sees advertising, which is really weird because both my partner and I work in advertising and marketing. So we're like, huh. It's interesting.
Oh,
it's kind of like future-proofing my mind. But it's a really weird thing, like asking her what she wanted for Christmas. And she was like, it was totally from her imagination because she'd never seen an ad. And that's very different. So I think it's how things progress. And, you know, the social platforms at the moment are obviously just going through that period that maybe TV advertising was going through 20, 30 years ago, where it was just overly saturated. And it was almost like, you know, it was just too much.
Has the implementation of ad blockers actually been good for you as more brands look to doing influencer marketing to avoid ad blockers?
That hasn't actually been part of our conversation with brands. I mean, Mumsnet has a display and programmatic ad team, and they're doing as well as they ever have. So it's not necessarily been a major reason why our team is growing. I think it's partly, it's a buzzword at the moment. Suddenly brands are really aware of influencer marketing and everyone's trying it, so should I. Yeah, that's very possibly part of the reason.
Although you haven't ruled it out, you did mention earlier that potentially talent management could happen mm-hmm. in the future. Some of the influencers that you mentioned on that McDonald's campaign on the more micro, macro mm-hmm. level do have management. So how does your relationship work with management?
We have a really close relationship with most of the talent agencies, partly because our network has been around for so long. Most of them started with us, and we're really fortunate with that perspective because they start with us, they grow with us, they kind of like our brand, they like our team. So once they get an agent, they introduce us to the agent and they say, look, I'm going to be working through, I don't know, Joe Talent now. But
do you not feel like you've missed an opportunity there, though, when they started with you and then they go outside, you already had access to them?
Very possibly, but it's just not something we currently are looking to resource. Mumsnet's been around for a long time, and part of the reason it's done well is because they're very sensible about what they invest in, they're very cautious, and they choose to look to profit and growth simultaneously as opposed to running before you can walk. So
who would you say Mumsnet's kind of competition is in the influencer space, and how do you differentiate?
Ooh.
Or do you have a monopoly?
No, we definitely don't have a monopoly. The GOAT agency is somebody I keep an eye on. They've come out of nowhere in the last couple of years and they're doing some really exciting stuff.
In the parenting space as well.
Yeah, so that's why I'm now keeping an eye on them. So they were kind of gambling in sport, and I kept an eye on them previously because I was like, ooh, wow, they've done really well. As
people safe. Involved in gambling are going to have to make a sudden change because this summer the new regulations come in. I think agencies are going to be really stung with that.
There's a few different pieces of legislation coming in, and I think it'll be interesting. But then they ran something with parent influencers and Lidl last summer on Instagram, and we kind of sat up and went, oh, hello, get out of our space. No, thank you. Obviously, and this is in terms of Mumsnet, obviously there's Net Mums, there's Channel Mum, there's different websites that cater to parents. But in terms of influencer marketing, I think common agencies, as opposed to particularly parent influencer agencies, are just as much a threat to us because everyone wants a piece of the parenting pie. It's, you know, been dubbed the $1 billion industry. So yeah, we're kind of watching our backs at the moment. We've had a head start, I suppose.
Net Mums, a competitor, I'm surprised they managed to get that name.
They started, I believe, don't quote me on this, before my time, they started within a year of each other back in the day. Oh. So it was probably a bit of a fight to the death, and then they both ended up surviving. So
realising they could survive.
Yeah.
Talent management for parenting bloggers. What are your views on kidfluencers?
This is a really complicated space. I was actually chatting to an agent specifically for kidfluencers in the summer, and she had come from a more traditional kid talent background, and she had a really interesting perspective that was, kid talent is not new. The difference is that if you have a child performing on the West End, there are such strict rules about the amount of time, the amount of, you know, school they can and cannot miss. And the law is that ultimately it's the head teacher of their schools, they get final say over whether or not they can do the job. Because if they're not keeping up at school, that is the priority, which I thought was really interesting. Where it gets really complicated is, what if the child isn't talent? It's the parent that's talent. But obviously with the way parent influencers work, for the vast majority of them, the kids form a massive part of that channel and that brand and that content. So we had a really lovely experience recently. We had a what we would dub a social star in recently to film with us at Mumsnet, and her daughter, who's 7, came in and she was part of the filming. And before they'd arrived, Maggie had said, would you mind if you just put, I think it was about £50, in an envelope from my fee with her name on it, And would you mind giving her the envelope at the end of filming? Because I really want to start to teach her about getting paid for a job and kind of the value of money and all of that. And we just thought that was so lovely. And she was so excited, this seven-year-old, when we passed over this envelope. She was just like, oh my God, I've been paid. Like, oh, this is so cool. And, you know, and then when she saw the video, obviously she would have seen the finished article of what she'd produced. And it's kind of that conscious understanding of, right, this is a job. This is something that I'm being paid to do. And I guess the conversation that may or may not come with that later is, what's your decision? Do you want to do it? We've had another lady who, if the kids are involved in filming, they have a set fee as well, which she's putting aside to go towards their university fees. So they're not getting that money in an envelope directly. But slowly, slowly, the parent influencers, especially the bigger ones, are clocking on that actually the kids, you know, I probably wouldn't have these channels without them, or I might, but it'd be on something very different. So they're kind of using that as an opportunity to have that conversation with the kids as well.
I suppose with the example of that, it's nothing new, and used to have child stars on the West End, those children were playing characters as opposed to kidfluencers are actually just showing their daily lives. Has there been any feedback on the kind of effect on children it has at school?
Not that I've heard, but I'd be really interested if anyone is listening and has that information, please do get in touch, because it's something that my team talks about more from just an interest perspective. And it's something our influencers on the network are constantly toying with, you know, do I show my child? Do I share their name? And how much is it that you're willing to share of their upbringing and their growing up versus then when they turn 16, 18, 21, what if they want to detach from that? And how far is too far? And there are no hard and fast rules at the moment. And at Mumsnet, our recommendation would always be you as the parent have to make that decision. They are your children. It's your family. You have to do what feels right to you and what feels comfortable. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that one of the biggest problems, I think, with our industry that is struggling with at the moment is integrity. And this is part of that conversation, I think. If something doesn't feel right, even if it's, you know, that you want to do a swimwear brand, which would mean that your son is in his trunks, if that doesn't feel right to you for some reason, then don't do it. You know, and as hard as it can be to turn down the money when you're freelance and things, it's not authentic. It's not with integrity. And if it's not, then actually, is it worth it? Especially with parent influencers who've got so much on the line raising children and things and making sure you're making those right decisions, it can feel like a lot of pressure. So just don't do it if it doesn't feel comfortable.
In your personal opinion, how ethical do you think it is?
I think it's as ethical as the parent themselves thinks it is. You know, as I said, I've got one lady who literally doesn't show her children at all, yet she is known as a parent influencer because family life is absolutely what she writes about. So it's, you know, it's not for me to say, to be honest, because it is a parent's own decision for their own family.
I think if we're kind of looking at statistics as well, I think it was at the end of last year that the top earning YouTube channels came out, and number one is Ryan's Toy Review,
yes,
who's seven and earned $22 million. So I think actually in terms of kind of brands and advertisers, when a lot of them are going after the late teen audience, those are people that actually probably don't have a lot of disposable income. But when you go to an older demographic, or indeed a very young demographic, by default they have parents who are going to have probably more of a disposable income, and it's actually a great way to target there.
Yep.
I'm doing a sales pitch for you.
Yeah. Do you want to come into the office every now and again?
I don't even have kids, but I was surprised. Yeah. What do you think is the most exciting thing about the influencer industry?
Ooh.
And its potential?
It is a hotbed of creativity. When I used to blog back in the day, you're in these Facebook groups, obviously there's hundreds of them, where they all kind of share ideas. And as soon as there's a change, I remember when Instagram announced the algorithm introduction and the goodbye to chronology, you know, the ideas that were bouncing around, and like when Stories launched or all of these things, the ideas that kind of bounce around within those groups are so exciting. And I don't think the advertising industry has had that quite on this spectrum before, because obviously agencies and brands have always had quite a monopoly on it, especially going back even further sort of to pre-90s. was kind of a few key agencies, wasn't it, that kind of led the way. So I think that's one of the really exciting, it's almost like the democratization of marketing. And I think what we're going to see more and more is less about mass broadcasting from, you know, Kim Kardashian, who's got millions and millions and millions, because you can do that with a TV channel, effectively. Actually, you're going to start really coming down into these mini, micro, micro audiences and really having that engaged, small conversation. And fine, it might only be with 50,000 people, but if 50% of them all go out and buy your product or all follow your brand on social because they want to hear more, that is far more powerful than having 2 million people and actually only 50,000 of them come and follow you or whatever it might be, because the ratio and probably the spend that you've put into that, nowhere near as effective.
What are your aims for kind of Mumsnet influencer department over the next 12 months?
We are looking to grow, obviously. We want to do more long-term and kind of deeper relationships. We work predominantly in that mini micro space that I talked about, under 100K, and it's those small conversations with the deep, highly engaged audiences that we're really interested in. We see lots of that on the Mumsnet forum. You know, people will come and go to the area of the forum that means the most to them, and that's effectively the same thing. So we're looking for those long-term deep relationships with not just the influencer, but more importantly, their audience, and getting brands to sort of understand that industry and that how that works a bit better.
And then what would you say to a listener who does have that kind of preconception of Mumsnet in the same mainstream media sort of negative, cruel, vitriolic, bitchy forum?
I mean, tell us what you're really thinking, Alice.
This isn't me. I'm just saying that that is a potentially superficial perception, but that is very widespread. And so how are you, you know, the kind of opportunity to change the narrative? Obviously, we talked earlier about what drew you to the platform and the network was that it wanted to champion working mums and flexible working. So what would you say to someone that hasn't really heard that kind of side of it? And or are you even trying to change their minds? Is that part of mum?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say don't judge a book by its cover, as cliched as that is, sorry. You know, there's a whole area of the website called Mums Network, and we are helping brands understand how they can use their apprenticeship levy to actually train mums coming back from a, or women rather, coming back from a career break, raising children over a long period of time and helping them get back into the workforce. That's a massive part of what that team is doing. Equally, the jobs board that we have, heroes, flexible and part-time working that you might do from home, you might do from an office, but we would never have a job on there, or we would not encourage brands to be on our job board that don't agree with our family-friendly policies at work. And that's a massive part of what everything we're doing internally. Feminism is intrinsic with the brand. Everyone internally, all the women, we're all there for all the right reasons. Just because that's what the Daily Mail, the Sun, whoever else it might be, are talking about, delve a little bit deeper. Come and find out for yourself and make your own opinion.
Do you think that we can get to a point in the future where the gender kind of pay gap is ironed out? I was watching a documentary recently and it was saying actually it's not just a gender pay gap, it's more specifically a mother penalty.
My God, I hope we can get there. This is something I am personally so passionate about. I could talk a whole other podcast episode about all my problems with this.
But that also leads into the same thing. It's like, you know, when a group of women come together collectively to have a voice, it's so easy to just tar as a silly brush, which goes into that kind of internalized misogyny we were discussing earlier.
Yeah, and I think that Mumsnet suffers from that because it is predominantly female. It's called Mumsnet. And the fact that Mumsnet has been very political, especially in the last 10 years, and it's not afraid of an educated debate, whether that's with Gordon Brown, asking him what biscuit he's having, or getting involved with things like the gender pay gap. You know, we're really not afraid to be intelligent and to have that conversation with the right people. We're part of a massive Better Postnatal Care campaign at the moment with the NHS, trying to improve conditions for women in the NHS after having a baby and making sure that actually there's something called the husband stitch, for example, where this might be a bit graphic for some listeners, I apologise. Basically, after you have a baby, you may need to go into surgery and be stitched up a little bit. And there have been cases where they will put an extra stitch in so you're a bit tighter. But actually, that causes all manner of problems. And that's just one form of trauma that a woman may have after birth. And there's never mind all the mental stuff that can happen. So, you know, we're really not afraid to campaign and get stuck in and have those really difficult conversations. And I think that as a result, there's a lot of society and the press and makes this easy fodder because actually we're a group of women. We've got something to say. So let's target them.
Do you think that one of the kind of solutions could be that the government puts more money into subsidising childcare to improve?
Well, that would be the dream, wouldn't it? They're taking it all away, though, so that's not going to happen.
It's so frightening, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And also you get, you know, the likes of the editor of Cosmopolitan doing an interview and saying, I decided not to have children so I could get to this position in my career.
Yeah, I think that is hugely powerful. It's really sad, but for her to have the bravery to say that, I actually really applauded her because I think unless more and more women are willing to either say that that's what they've had, or on the flip side, women who have suffered as a result of having children, we won't get anywhere. But you've also got the flip side that men have got to step up and be willing to take more flexible working and be willing to kind of have that equality in the house. Like my partner, for example, he's requested flexible working at work because we could never have made it work otherwise because I work in London and he happens to work outside of London where we live. So once a week, he leaves work at 3:30 so he can pick our daughter up at a good time. And that's one day of the week that I don't have to worry. My mum also chips in. And it's about, you know, that whole, it takes a village. Yet your husband or your partner or whoever your support network are, they are part of your village and everyone has to pull their weight. It cannot keep resting on just that one mum and maybe her mum in the family to chip in.
I think although we kind of went a bit off,
we did,
off
sorry,
the tangent,
I
think that's probably a good place to wrap. Is there anything that you wanted to talk about that we didn't cover?
No, I think that was a very varied and
yeah,
very
it's gonna be really
meaty
good
conversation.
A big thanks to Amy for coming on the show.
You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. Be sure to check out blogospheremagazine.com for influencer industry updates. And why not treat yourself to a magazine subscription whilst you're there?